Mike Rabinovich here, and this is the Modelo's Conversations with Data Warehouse Experts podcast series. Our mission in these podcasts is to speak to the best minds in the data warehouse and BI space, and to get their take on the state of the business and find out what they think the future holds. We are also committed to do it in a way that adds value to tech professionals, while at the same time is clear and compelling for the business managers and executives they collaborate with every day. In today's podcast, our guest is preeminent business intelligence analyst, speaker, and author, Dr. Barry Devlin, founder and principal of Ninesight Consulting. Many consider him to be the godfather of the data warehousing industry, defining its first architecture in 1985. He's joining us from Cape Town, South Africa. Welcome, Barry.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
We're glad you joined us, and I'd like to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about your background for our listeners that have not had a chance to hear you speak or read any of your books.
Absolutely. Let me say, first of all, you can probably hear that I'm not South African, or at least the South Africans among the audience will know that instantly. I'm actually Irish, and most of my life was based in Dublin in Ireland. And back in the early 80s, I started working for IBM. As a young ingenue essentially there, and one of the first things they asked me to do was to do a piece of architecture for decision support systems within IBM at the time. And you may remember back then that was a mainframe company essentially, but also had a few mid-range computers, which eventually became the AS400. So they were trying to figure out how to manage their sales and how to do essentially decision support. And out of that came data warehousing. Back in 1985, before Inman wrote his book, the first architecture paper that I published was in the IBM Systems Journal back in 1988, which described the data warehouse architecture. Since then, I worked for IBM for many more years, being a manager, a consultant, and eventually ended up being something called a distinguished engineer, which is a fairly grandiose title in IBM, but I've never met an engineer who's distinguished, so I've always wondered about it. So by 2008, I think I'd tired of being distinguished and an engineer and left to set up Ninesight Consulting. But I've always been involved in the area of information and of data and its use within businesses and indeed beyond businesses. And so that's where I focus still as a consultant, as an analyst. I'm mostly these days working as an analyst, which of course means working with software vendors, but also wanting to keep my hand in with real companies doing real work. And that's always, I think, the really interesting part.
Where have you seen the most significant changes in the data warehouse space over, let's say, the last 5 years?
Yeah, I think the thing that has really struck me most has been the emergence of externally sourced data as a huge input to data warehousing. Now, most people would call this big data, and big data is probably not a great name for it, although most of it does have characteristics of being big. But I think the more interesting things about this data is that it's coming in very different structures. It's coming with very different quality characteristics. It's coming with very different rates of feed, sizes, etc., etc. And it is a very different type of data than we fed into data warehouses back in the 80s and the 90s and even into the early 2000s. And the availability of this data has then enabled, I think, the other big thing that I've seen changing in the data warehouse space, which is a move from business intelligence to analytics. Now, many people would I suppose, hesitate as to what that actually meant. But for me, business intelligence in a way was knowing what questions to ask, whereas analytics is almost about drawing statistical inferences from the different parts of the data that you've got. And I think what that's done is it's really changed people's way of thinking about the use of data within the organization, the use of information in the business, and how you can begin to predict the future and indeed proactively influence future behaviors using it. And that's goodness. I mean, that's a really big thing that you know, Gartner would talk about in terms of digital business and so on. But I often think there's also a downside to it, which is that as we've now moved from the old days of simply, you know, asking questions and doing some analysis and trying to figure out what the problem with the market is and why our sales dropped in Midwest, et cetera, et cetera. Now we're sort of doing things which I think are very impactful in terms of privacy, in terms of the public perception, in terms of the economy. So we've really moved from being, you know, a small internal type of organization and function within businesses to being very much on the front row. And I think we're not really thinking enough about the ethics of what we're doing in this instance.
Now, as you look at the current slew of data warehouse products in the marketplace, do you feel, based on your historical experience, that they're addressing the increasing complexity of data as well as the exponential increase in data flows and sources?
You know, I think it depends on how you define current data warehouse products. Many products that were a few years ago talked about as big data products are now doing some form of data warehousing. So you see that in, you know, the emergence of relational function and analytic function within the Hadoop sphere and the NoSQL sphere. All of those things are, to me, addressing, if you like, the increasing complexity of the data, the exponential increase in the data flows, as you say, but they're actually probably not the products that you would have thought of as being data warehouse products in the past. But that's not to say that many of the long-standing players in the data warehouse field are also upping their game. One very recent set of announcements, for example, from Teradata with their Teradata Analytic Platform and IntelliSphere, as they've called them, are examples of an old, I mean, Teradata was the original data warehouse vendor, really stepping up to analytics, stepping up to different types of data, different platforms, the ability to bring data in from other platforms. And it's very interesting to see people like Teradata, Informatica doing the same, really adopting a lot of the changes, the new data types, the new approaches to data. Informatica, interesting as well, you know, they've introduced this thing called CLAIRE, which is an AI program, which is embedded within their products now to help in terms of modeling, in terms of ETL. So I'm sure you know about that as from the Dimodulo side as well. But these are, I think, examples of these both the new vendors and the old vendors really stepping up to this data complexity.
Now, speaking about, you know, the core, the essence of data warehousing here, I've read, you know, probably over the last few years, you know, an article here and there by some, you know, fairly smart folk, I guess, that are heralding the death of the data warehouse. What's your take on that?
Well, let me tell you, Mike, anybody threatening to murder my baby will have to deal with me first. you know, I'm not the illegitimate grandfather of data warehousing for nothing, but I don't think that the data warehouse is dead, but I think it's morphing in many, many different ways. So I think many people forget that data warehouse is actually an architecture, and being an architecture, how it gets implemented is less important than actually following the principles of it. And so what is the purpose or the principles of a data warehouse architecture? Well, to me, it is always about consistent and timely data for decision-making support. And I don't think those needs are ever going to go away. They certainly haven't gone away yet. More to the fact, I think the technical environment and the business environment today is so much more complex than it ever was. So whatever we call it, this set of architectural concepts that, you know, emerged with the data warehouse, I think will continue to exist and will have an even bigger role. You know, some people also talk about, you know, the data lake as a successor to the data warehouse. I've heard that a lot. I'm sure you have too. But, you know, people who build, or should I say dig, data lakes, they still will have to address the timeliness and consistency issues anyway. So renaming the construct from a warehouse to a lake may sound cute, but it actually doesn't help in terms of addressing the issues.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, one of the purposes of what we're doing here in our podcast is not simply talking to tech professionals, which obviously we are, but helping the business C-suite understand a little bit better when they speak to their technical teams as to what they're trying to convey, mm-hmm. and the value proposition. And I've seen that data lake being brought up by executives at meetings and events that I've attended, but it's not always clear that they understand the difference between the data lake and what a data warehouse does. So if you could just, you know, really give the nub of that would be great.
Well, I'm not sure that you like the answer that much. To me, the data lake is actually just a conglomeration of technology products from an open source stack standpoint that have been thrown together in order to deal with the topic of big data. I think it's a very different concept than a data warehouse, which started as an architecture, as a set of rules, a set of things that you need to address, principles that you need to do about how do I make data consistent, how do I manage its quality, how do I ensure its availability, how do I balance timeliness and consistency.
Right.
All of those sort of issues are architectural design issues, which you actually have to think about before you choose your products. And I think the problem for me with data lake, even though I must say this just to honor the people who are now doing it, it has evolved over the years from being simply a group of product stuff to some sort of architecture. So the, you know, the Clouderas and the Hortonworks and those guys have thought about architecture, but it was only after a few years of selling product that they started doing it. So to me, the difference between them is this, to put it in a nutshell for a business person. If you want to have decision making that's based on the best available data, you need to do some architecting of your data and of your data feeds in advance. That means doing a data warehouse, no matter what you call it. That data warehouse could be done on a set of technology, as it was in the past, like relational databases, or as the Hadoop people and the NoSQL people would say today, do it on the open source stacks. That doesn't really matter at the end of the day. From the principle of getting quality and consistent data, it's really important that you first of all think about how you do that, and then decide what the implementation, the physical implementation, is going to be.
Well, that's a great summary, Barry, because what I was driving at is that I would go to these events and I would hear from, you know, VPs or you know, different people that are considering these initiatives, that a data lake essentially replaces the data warehouse. And I'm glad you clarified that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, I want to turn and talk a little bit about the cloud. As more and more companies are adopting it, be it an old cloud model, a hybrid model, what do you think is going to be the impact on their data warehousing project?
To me, the real impact is going to be a huge increase in complexity. Now, I know that from a business point of view, there's a lot of other things going on that you say, well, we get more flexibility, we don't have to invest capital, we can do OpEx instead, etc., etc. But I think when you say impact, I think to me the impact is going to be about the increase in complexity, because essentially what you're doing here is moving from an environment where the data that you needed and that you used for your data warehouse was essentially all internally sourced, internally managed, internally used. You're now moving to an environment where the data that you want to use is both externally and internally sourced. You're talking about saving or storing a lot of it in the cloud, which is obviously external to your enterprise boundary. But you're not going to be putting all of it out there, so some of it is going to be internal. So you've got this issue of data moving back and forth across the boundary between on premises and the cloud, which is, can be an expensive and troublesome procedure. You've got all sorts of issues that are now emerging around geography, as in where is your data actually going to sit, and you know, if it's in the European Union, it has to follow these rules, and if it's in the US, it has to follow, well, probably no rules at all. But all of those issues start coming up. So that complexity of data management is, I believe, a major impact on the implementation. And then, of course, the physical architecture, the technology, and so on and so forth. So there, I mean, I focused a little bit on the negatives. And you said before we started that you're a guy who sees the glass three quarters full.
I did.
I think I'm a guy who sees the glass three quarters empty. So you know, I think these are the sort of impacts that you have to deal with. I think there's a lot of, you know, technical selling goes on out there saying, you know, this cloud is going to solve everything, and if only we have a cloud, it's going to really make the difference. But, and there are certainly, as I say, good things about it. But I think we really need to keep in mind that what essentially we're doing is building a very complex distributed data environment, and that's got to be more of a challenge than building a much more integrated and single environment data warehouse.
I want to turn now to your book, Business on Intelligence, Insight and Innovation Beyond Analytics and Big Data, which came out in 2013. I mean, those are always huge projects. So what compelled you to write it?
Well, I think it was about the principles of data warehousing. You know, when I started thinking about this book around 2010, the data warehouse architecture at that stage was about 25 years old. And that is a hugely long time in the technology industry, right? I mean, it's crazy. I mean, when I started doing data warehousing, I had a lot of hair. Now I've none. The changes in the business needs, in the technology possibilities have been huge since then. And I think what was driving me was this, I wanted to really try and address the issues that were raised by these new data types and sources, like, as I said, externally sourced data, the data volumes. I wanted to really try and see what did that mean for the issues that drove data warehousing. And I started off, I think, even a few years earlier, writing down what I thought were the original postulates of the data warehousing, and then coming up with new ones for the modern era, which are much more relevant to what it is people are trying to do today with data in the business sense. And back in 2010 and 2012, what I think I could say was that people were then and probably still are mostly doing one of two things. They're either trying to push all of this new stuff, all of this new information, all of these new needs into the old architectural model. Inman's DW 2.0, for example, is one way of doing that. Or they're on the other hand, just thinking technology, which is saying, oh, you know, what's the problem? Oh, Hadoop is the answer. So I wanted to really sort of step back from that and come up with some modern principles and get back to the first principles of architecture and start anew. And I sort of came to this phrase, and it's actually reflected in the book and in the architecture, that there are three, if you like, thinking spaces that you need to deal with. And I called those spaces information as a foundation, process as the middle piece that you use to do stuff to and from information, and then the top piece, which is people. So this idea of information, process, and people are the three principles, the three things we really have to think about in terms of this architecture. And it just turned out that when you then reverse that around, it becomes a very nice sentence which says people process information. And that's essentially what we're trying to do, is to try to create an environment to allow people to process information to run their businesses.
I particularly like the reference to business on intelligence in the book's title. How would you explain that concept to business managers or executives who are conversant in tech, but far from being experts.
That name, Business on Intelligence, was actually a very late idea in the writing of the book. And I'm, to be honest, I'm not actually sure how successful it was. I have a feeling that people look at it and think, this is a glass three quarters empty view of business intelligence. So the reason that it came up for me was that as the book evolved and I started to deal with the people aspect that I've just mentioned, I got very interested in how do people make decisions. And what I began to discover as I dug deeper into it is that the belief system that management consultants and management schools of management have is that businesses make decisions based on rational choice theory. And we don't probably have time to talk a lot about rational choice theory, but it is a way of you know, trying to balance out all of the different aspects and probabilities of things happening. And the more I thought about it, the more I said, do I really make decisions that way? Is that really how people make decisions? And it became clear that, to me at least, that no, emotions are involved, physical energy is involved, bias is involved, societal interactions are all at play. All of these things come into how people make decisions. Mm. So I just wanted to show that there was more to decision making than rational choice. And of course, that meant that it's not just about intelligence, it's about something beyond intelligence. Right. And that's where the unintelligence, the idea of unintelligence, came from. It actually came from the idea of the undead, which is another diversion, which we probably should go into another day.
Okay, so, well, we can do a round two on that for sure.
But there's a lot of ideas in this area around how do people make decisions and how do they actually get from the information that's in their BI systems, in their warehouses, to the context around it, to the information, the contextual information, to knowledge, if you want to call it that, and then on to meaning. But that's something that's very difficult to incorporate into BI technology. And we've never really thought too much about it. And this is really something I'm passionate about at the moment, is that this is really important now, because it's even more important than it ever was, because we're now at this stage where there is a story going around that we're about to use AI to eliminate bias, for example, from decision making. And we've no idea what biases we're trying to eliminate. We're going down a path, as we usually do, a technology of it's going to solve the problems of the world without considering what the problem is. We're going to augment, we're going to automate, we're going to solve all the decision making problems with AI. We haven't really even figured out how it is that we would represent business decision making in a sensible way.
I want to turn and deal with a topic that's closer to our hearts, because we do it every day. But how do you think data warehouse automation is changing the delivery of information to the business?
I've been really impressed with data warehouse automation as a set of thinking, as a set of concepts, since the early days when I came across it, in probably the early 2000s, because I think what it really struck me was that, in contrast to previous thinking, it was what I might call a whole process view. So it took the whole process from the idea of, well, we've got a set of structures and prior art, if you like, in our operational systems, and we're not just interested in how to get it out and to cleanse it. What we're actually interested in, how do we get it all the way from the operational world into the warehouse, into the marts, whatever it happens to be that you're trying to populate, as a complete process. And you have to take all of the steps into account. You can't just focus on, let's say, the technology of how do my data engineers do a translation from this form to that form. We actually have to figure it out from the business point of view, all the way down to the technology. So data warehouse automation, to me, is also great in the way it insists at least in most of the tools, that business involvement is a vital part of what you're trying to do. So this, first of all, holistic view of the process, and secondly, this idea that it is a collaboration between business and IT to make it work. I think they're the two things that change the delivery of information.
When looking at data warehouse projects, which are notoriously over budget and take too long, if you're asked for your advice by a business suite and was asked, what is the one thing that we have to know or that we must do before launching into a data warehouse project, what would that be?
I would say make a plan. it's a very South African phrase here to make a plan. But I think it is really important that you start from the beginning and make a plan. When I start with a data warehouse project or consulting on a data warehouse project, there are very few greenfield projects these days. I mean, they're generally what we call brownfield projects. In other words, this is the seventh time we've tried to build this thing. The thing that I always miss is that the clients are always in a hurry to get to the product choice, to the populate the database, to, you know, just do stuff. And I really have to stop them and say, you know, no, actually, you need to try and figure out how it is you're going to get all of these things working together. You have to make sure that the business people who are coming from many different departments are all aligned behind the same direction. They have to realize that somebody's going to get first delivery and somebody's going to get last delivery. How do you make sure that they're all going to agree on this and continue to agree on this? Because, as you said, these projects and processes take a long time. So making a plan, figuring out how to create a team that will manage that plan. They're often called a BI center of competence or center of excellence. Who are the people that need to be in that team? And what are the personalities you need in that team to make sure that it works? Then you can start thinking about, well, am I going to use data warehouse automation or am I going to use ETL? Will I go with Teradata or will I go with Hadoop? All of those things are sort of much further down the path. If you haven't got a plan that tells you how to get from the beginning to the end of the process, I sort of think you're wasting your time.
So I guess the imperative here is to plan your work and work your plan.
Absolutely.
So I want to switch gears a little bit to kind of a different segment of the podcast where we get to know our guests a little bit better, and it has nothing to do with tech. So my first question to you, if you're ready, Barry, is what is the one book that you would recommend most to people, and it's a non-tech book, has nothing to do with what we're talking about?
Yeah, I have to say to you, and this is going to sound a little strange perhaps, but if probably 10 or 15 years ago at this stage, I came across, it's not one book, but it's a series of books, and they're called Conversations with God by an author called Neil Donald Walsh. And given my background I have a PhD in physical chemistry, you would not think probably that I was going to be recommending a book called Conversations with God. But it really opened my eyes to looking at the world in a different way, to thinking about what we do in the world and how we are in the world. So as a completely off the wall topic, I would say, have a look at volume one of Conversations with God and see what you think.
You know, I've heard of it. I haven't read it, but that's a great recommendation. And who is the author again, Barry?
A guy called Neil Donald Walsh.
Neil Donald Walsh. Excellent. And another question is, what is the one TV show that you're watching or binging on, as the case may be right now?
I'm not going to do what I'm tell you what I'm binging on at the moment, because it's a bit too gauche. I'll tell you what the thing is. I am really a fan of European and even English. Is English and European the same thing? That's a good question in these Brexit days. English TV and European TV. So certainly there's a couple of things. I love the Nordic noir. Nordic noirs as a genre has some really great stuff in it. And one set of one series was called The Bridge, which was a crime series set on the bridge between Copenhagen and Malmo in Sweden, and on either side of it. Obviously, it didn't all happen on the bridge, but it opens on the bridge, and it's a very good series, very dark, but also a very, very nicely made series. That was one that sticks in my mind that I've watched recently. And the other one is a set of is based on books by a guy called Robert Galbraith, who turns out to be a nom de plume for J.K. Rowling. And these are Strike. Series, and they've been made into two of the books have been made into TV series. They've The Silkworm and The Cuckoo's Calling, and these are also very good series in terms of you know, the development of character. I like development of character. I like to see, you know, the underlying psychology of what's going on, as opposed to people chasing around at 130 miles per hour in cars, hitting the wall and walking away.
But it's interesting that you brought up Nordic noirs, because it just reminded me of another show that is on Netflix. It's called Occupied.
And I should write it down.
I don't know. Yeah, it's been a one season thing, but it's pretty interesting, and it's the same genre. But no, these are great recommendations. Thank you. So I want to conclude our podcast by asking you to share with our audience where they can find out more about you and the work that you do.
Well, I'm afraid that we're back to now the boring stuff. I would say, first of all, go buy my book. Could I avoid saying that? Absolutely not.
Of course not.
So, Business on Intelligence, it's out there, it's available, it's well worth a read. Is I think, if you have the time to sit down and think about architecture, principles, what we are doing with information in the world, I think you'll find it very interesting. At another level, I say go to my website, ninesight.com. Everything that I publish goes there. I don't actually ask for your email address to get to it. It's all freely available. And I'm happy if you write to me, email me about it and ask questions. And of course, follow me on Twitter, because, hey, listen, I'm more interesting than one the real Donald Trump.
And what's your handle?
It's Barry Devlin. Very awesome. Straightforward.
Thank you so much for your time today. It was great. And I think there's a lot more questions that I would love to ask, but so maybe we can do a round two down the road.
Mike, it's been a pleasure too.
And thanks for listening, everybody. And I will, when we upload it to the website, the podcast, we will have a list of URLs and resources that Barry had mentioned during the show, including his favorite books and TV shows. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Till next time.